You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. I grew up reading Asterix and Obelix stories. They were some of the few things that I was interested in reading in those years. Comics worked for me when little other reading grabbed my attention. Since those formative years, I've often found myself drawn to graphic novels and illustrated texts. I recently picked up such a book, written for young people, called Bad For You, Exposing the War on Fun. A very brief introduction explains the book. This is the history of stuff that is supposed to be bad for you. To find out why most of it isn't, keep reading. The next couple hundred pages lays out a history of trying to stop young people from doing things they enjoy. Dangerous things like reading, playing, and thinking, among many others. It's a fun read. The authors Kevin Pyle and Scott Cunningham expose the many ways adults have limited young people, or at least tried to. Often, actually harming young people in the process. Today I'm speaking with one of the authors and the illustrator, Kevin Pyle. Thank you, Kevin, and I appreciate you joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I want to start by asking you, what's attracted you to the medium of comics and illustration, Kevin?
I actually came to comics somewhat later in my career. I started out as primarily as an illustrator. I'm one of those kids who I don't really remember a time when I didn't draw. And so it was sort of, for me, just I ended up arriving at comics after I spent, if we go back to the beginning, growing up, a friend of mine and I would like to redraw Mad magazines as like a pastime. I had, you know, friends that I would run around with outside, and then another friend or two that I would draw with. But I wasn't really that attracted. I wasn't like a superhero comic guy. And when I got to college, everybody was doing abstract painting, and I was doing that for a while. But I grew up at the time of punk rock, and I was really kind of into punk rock imagery and all that kind of thing. And there wasn't a lot of room in art school for that, so I sort of gravitated to doing illustration and doing illustration about sort of dark subjects, and which brought me to doing, you know, opinion illustration. So I went to college in Kansas. When I moved to New York, I started working for the newspapers and doing things on like death penalty and social justice issues, and eventually I started wanting to sort of write the content that I was illustrating. So for a while I did a lot of comics and still do comics around social justice issues. But at one point I was working as a part-time children's designer at Scholastic, and they started being interested. This is sort of the early 2000s, late 90s, more mainstream publishers got interested in graphic novels as the phenomenon grew. And I...
Interested in graphic novels as Scholastic, I think of as an educational text?
Well, as educational or doing graphic novels for a teen market. Okay. And doing graphic novels for, you know, teen graphic novels before that had really existed in smaller markets. And the term graphic novel was sort of denoted comics about subjects besides, you know, superheroes or funny animals and that sort of thing. And that was the kind of area that I was working in. But I ended up proposing a book about my own experiences growing up, one of which was getting in trouble in class for drawing instead of doing my math tests. There's a story in my family of my parents actually having to come to school because I kept just drawing pictures on my math tests and saying that that was my answer. You can grade this, you know.
And what were your grades like?
Not very good.
Okay, that's too bad.
But in any case, to make a long story short, but I think I've already made it rather long, I would say that I sort of fell into doing comics, and I started doing comics about the experience, sort of rites of passage comics or experiences I had growing up. And I did a few graphic novels on that subject, and they were also informed by a strong anti-authoritarian kind of social justice angle. And then at one point, I hit upon the idea with my co-writer of Bad For You, this history of moral panics. And in some ways, it brings together the social justice comics that I was doing for the adult audience with this other market that I'd done three graphic novels for. all with the same publisher, Henry Holt. And so it's kind of, in some ways, it's also like going way back to my first love of Mad Magazine, because it's kind of is informed by that whole sensibility.
It seems like so many illustrators, graphic novelists talk about Mad Magazine as their formative comic text, illustrated text. I'm quite intrigued by that.
Well, I think especially if you were a kid like myself who wasn't necessarily that interested in superheroes, you'd be looking at the newsstand for other, you know, you'd love to draw, and maybe you had a critical eye towards the sort of violent conflict resolution type of comics, you know. I mean, there's certainly a pleasure in superhero comics, but it's not something I deeply connected to, like I did Mad Magazine.
Yeah. So. You use comics now with young people. You do workshops, you teach in schools. What's your response using art and illustration and comics with young people?
Well, it's interesting. I started getting into teaching. Some of the first programs that I was involved in were, well, one was working for the Center for Urban Pedagogy in New York City, where I worked in East Harlem, working with students to do comics about their experience with the criminal justice system. And I also did an early workshop, and my early teaching experiences came out of my adult social justice work. But when I became a published author working in the market for middle school readers, I started doing more visiting artist things and started to see the educational possibilities of comics, often because kids were just so enthusiastic about them. Now I do a lot of teaching. I also do consulting, where I'm working with teachers trying to integrate art into a history curriculum or into Greek myths or things like that as another avenue of learning and another way for students to express their knowledge. Some of those, I've often found I go into classes and I hear back from teachers that there are kids who are so totally disconnected from the educational experience that are suddenly inspired by this particular project and are displaying knowledge that the teacher didn't necessarily know that they even had.
Any insights into what it is that illustration or images brings to these young people?
Well, I think it could be, you know, for one, if they're not very strong readers, you know, they're attracted to comics because everybody loves stories, mm-hmm. but they're attracted to the storytelling, and the same with movies, but they don't have avenues, they can't express themselves in that media in school. They're not given that opportunity. So I think they sort of jump at it. I think they see it as somehow separate or from you know, the barrage of testing, and even, you know, when they do get to write stories, that's not something they necessarily might aspire to as much as they would to doing a comic or a movie. I mean, I think you could even just, rather than having children write short stories, you could try having them write movie scripts, and you would get another layer, you know, another level of enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. You talk about you being, you know, your parents being brought in because of your drawing. Now you've been brought in to draw with young people. My understanding, certainly up in Canada, and I assume it's similar in the U.S., is that there tends to be a bit of a war against art, particularly art in schools, and more arts programs are being cut. Are you finding that experience in schools, and how are you getting into schools?
Well, one strategy which has worked really well is that I've identified, I've gone through all the language arts Common Core standards, and I've identified things like sequencing and cause and effect and character development, and shown and demonstrated how comics address all these sort of standards. And it's really a strategy for getting into the schools. And also, frankly, there's a lot of teachers and administrators who aren't really happy about this trend either, but they feel that they need to justify. It's getting harder and harder for them to justify carving out space for the arts experience. So I've been very busy because comics are easy to justify in that sense. I don't think I could have done it 10, 15 years ago before comics hadn't reached a certain cultural place. I mean, artists like Art Spiegelman with his memoir of Mouse, you know, won the Pulitzer, and there's been a lot of talk. The American Library Association has really embraced graphic novels, and I think more and more administrators and teachers are really excited and open to the idea. I think it's not hard for them to see the language arts connections, whereas it's much more difficult, I think, for people with dance and music. I think that's getting harder than it used to be. I find it tragic and tremendously sad if kids don't have an arts experience in their education, because it's really where they get to experience a degree of freedom. And I think economically it's foolish to think that arts are not, I mean, everyone thinks of the poor artist, but in another way, you know, our cultural content is what America exports, and what we, you know, and independent of helping kids find what they want to do from a job standpoint, it just allows a sort of a place of freedom and a place of your spiritual growth, you know, and something that they can rely on to get pleasure out of their lives in the future.
I wholly agree with that. One of the things that you talk a lot about in the book are these rationales for ending programs, these rationales for stopping fun. And I want to talk about a bunch of those. Before we do that, though, I want to ask you, what's your evidence that arts are helpful for young people? I mean, you talk about language sequencing, but you make some pretty broad claims there about the benefit of arts. Is there any empirical support for that you're aware of?
Well, there have been studies showing how helpful comics are with ESL students, because they can use a lot of the language, they can use a lot of the visual clues. I've actually done some consulting in schools where I've worked with ESL kids, some of which are port of entry kids, where this is like the first school they've been in since they've arrived in a new country. And the teachers have been very positive about the comics experience, about how the mechanics of reading becomes is easier for the students to grasp in a comic format. And there have been studies with, you know, ESL, like I had mentioned, there have been studies exclusively on ESL students showing that it does have a positive effect. I believe I'm going back in the book and finding we did sort of a occasionally throughout the books we have a little side section called Good for You, which sort of goes against the prevailing wisdom of whatever media we're talking about where there might be good effects for it. And in the section on that, there's a sample study that showed that seventh graders from different economic levels, one upper class, suburban, one lower class, and urban, that comics led to more challenging reading. And you know, you see things like this, and when I work with kids and with the Greek myths, we'll be reading comics on, you know, comic versions of the Odyssey, and it helps them to then step up to sort of getting through the actual text of Homer. There was a detailed study that showed kids were more excited to learn about science when they used comics, and kids would prefer comics in their sort of summer reading, you know, when they had to choose them from their summer reading guides. I think it's not my area of expertise, but it's more my experience that enthusiasm leads to better learning. I think if a kid is excited about something, excited about a media, they'll engage with it in a different way.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. You know, as I said, you know, the graphic stories were one of the first things that really resonated for me in my own reading. What's the response been of the book from young people who have read it?
Oh, it's actually, I just ran into someone yesterday who had given it to their nephew for the holidays, and how they just couldn't tear them away from him. I think kids really, they really respond to the fact that somebody has written this history. I also do Comic-Cons, and I've some teenagers say, I can't believe there's a book like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't believe there's a book that, you know, points all this stuff out. Because, you know, it, you know, covers everything from adults worried about what kids are reading to them playing certain video games and, you know, texting and media and, you know, allowing them to play outside and all this sort of thing. And I think kids, you know, kids feel that the weight of those rules, especially teens, they feel the weight of those rules, and they tend to think it's just an accepted reality. So I think kids really respond to the fact that somebody has sort of chronicled and written all this, you know, put it all in a book, and especially in a format that they really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's an amazing. You do a nice job of illustrating, and then you know, text sections, which I need to admit, there were times where I was like, oh, well, maybe I can just flip through this text section and get right back to the comics. Maybe I shouldn't say that as an
educator. Well, the text sections really became necessary because, you know, my co-writer Scott Cunningham. Mm-hmm. He did a ton of the research while I was finishing up a graphic novel, and he and I both together turned up so much material that we found the text sections were necessary just to bring, just from a space issue, because it's you know, the comics necessitate a lot of editing to get the just enough room for the pictures on the page, and so you really have to get brief with things. And a book like this that really has a lot of sociological underpinnings and makes references to studies and stuff, it became necessary to have text sections just to get some things in there that we just couldn't stand to lose. But, you know, if you can tell the story in a paragraph instead of three pages, it really makes a difference.
Yeah, and the text, you know, I reluctantly would go back and return to the text sections, and I've found them immensely informative. The whole book deals with, you know, there's about seven chapters, six of which deal with the repression of fun. And then one, the shortest one actually, about organizations started by young people and how they're responding to repression. You mentioned video games and texting. You have a beautiful timeline around technology and starting 360 BCE with Plato and how society is going to crumble because people are writing things down now, and this is going to be the end of knowledge as we know it,
yeah.
Which really contextualizes it. Could you take us through a little bit of that fear of technology and where you think we are now with that?
Well, I think something we really wanted to do in the book is show that this is not a new phenomenon and that it changes, you know, it adjusts to each new technology that comes out, you know, in relationship to, well, you know, it's not all in just relationship to youth. There was the fear of the printing press, the fear of, you know, the books could actually be confusing and harmful to the brain. Worries about, you know, trains and electrical lines and things like that. I think in relationship to youth, one of the dynamics that plays out is whenever teens embrace a new technology, it just sort of feeds into a general fear of teens and you know, some of it coming out of maybe questioning of how things are already done and the sort of challenging nature that someone has at that age. But when kids are early adopters of a new technology, it sort of feeds that fear. And the media plays a big role in you know, highlighting the novelty of that technology and how that can lead to, you know, dangerous situations and et cetera. And it's sort of a recurring phenomenon that just changes with each technology. I mean, there were actually fears of when the telephone and the telegraph came out, that now like unsavory suitors would have access to young women. Mm-hmm. And that it had to be, you know, one had to keep an eye on. I think I have a quote here about the telephone. It's like, the doors may be barred and a rejected suitor kept out, but how is the telephone to be guarded? And there were these books about romances that happened because of the telegraph, of women, you know, falling into the hands of young girls falling into the hands of unsavory characters who wooed them over the telegraph. So
the obvious parallel to that, of course, is the fear of the internet and social networking and young women once again who are going to be lured into this dark, murky, exploitative world. And we certainly do see instances of that at times. How much of this do we need to be worried about? How much of this is, you know, the historical panic? How much of this is relevant?
Well, I think ultimately what often happens is there's a confusion between the technology, the new technology, that sort of the novelty of it, and the behavior that technology is being used for. So you know, obviously new technology comes out and it presents new challenges, but the technology is ultimately neutral and can be used for, you know, positive or negative ways. I think this is in some ways one of the more difficult chapters of the book because it's like, for instance, we didn't go very deeply into cyberbullying because I think cyberbullying is, you know, some instances of it have been really terrible. But then on the other side of it, it might be better to be cyberbullied than actually bullied. You know, as a child, some people like myself remember, you know, that experience. And so it's hard to know yet how deep a phenomenon it is, or if it could fall into, you know, sort of a moral panic situation. I think in all these cases, though, is we're not giving kids enough credit, teens enough credit to recognize these situations for themselves, you know, recognize unhealthy situations and exercise control over it.
Why do you think that you chronicle, you know, millennia of panic and fear and anxiety around young people and fun? Why do you think we have this ongoing anxiety about young people and fun?
Well, I think oftentimes, I mean, the media does play a big role in it. It's, you know, kids completely embrace something and then if they embrace it to an obsessive degree by some people's definition, then it sort of bears investigation. And sometimes I think adults are a lot of times uncomfortable with that stage where a child is no longer looking to the parent or authorities for knowledge, but they're looking towards their peers and looking to other people, you know, that they think may have a better understanding of the world. Yeah, some of it's media specific. I mean, it's, you know, something like with, you know, like the burning of Harry Potter books. Clearly that, you know, there's a fear there that the Harry Potter book is more exciting than, or more, the kids are more enthusiastic about that than a Bible. And so then that becomes an object of panic. But I think that, you know, there's the, you know, teens are at that stage where they're really, you know, they're thinking more for themselves and they're challenging some of the things that they're expected to take on faith. But, you know, there could be some sort of fascination and envy there. You know, kids really sort of embody an adventure and a moving forward that, you know, where adults are, at some point are more about sort of holding on to their resources and protecting them, where kids are out there sort of acquiring them and figuring out how the world works as opposed to sort of, you know, building up their walls against it. You know, it's interesting. I do really feel like the media, you know, at times this book felt like it was going to be more of a, and it definitely at times gets into being a media critique book. We have something like a media moral panic cycle.
Mm-hmm, which is wonderful, that cycle.
And, you know, there's this idea of the moral panic with the sociologist Stanley Cohen came up with, which is this, you know, there's something, phenomenon comes out that sort of is viewed as threatening the social order. And it's sort of, there's several hallmarks to it. You know, one is symbolization, where it's the participants in it are oversimplified, sort of like the punks, or he was talking about mods and rockers. But then there's in 70s England, late 60s England. But then there's exaggeration, where the facts of the controversy become distorted and it sort of fuels this moral crusade. And then there's always this prediction of further immoral actions, how it's sort of going to be taken to this next level that will truly threaten society. And there's roles, you know, and we have a lot of them in our book, of these, what you would call, he dubs moral entrepreneurs, who are people who their primary function is to raise these fears, and they may be writing books or appearing on talk shows, and you know, there might be, you know, well-meaning parents or religious figures, but they sort of, they gain currency through this exaggeration and simplification of this phenomenon. And it sort of happens over and over again, you know, and that's definitely one of the structures of the book, is showing how it started with the burning of comic books in the 50s, and how you saw it with Dungeons and Dragons, and you see it with texting and excessive screen time. And, you know, I think the point in our book, or violent video games, and the point in our book is not like that you should, that there should be no rules or no boundaries, but more that there should be a recognition of the role of hysteria, and how we're hoping that kids, when they read this book, and adults as well, that they'll kind of recognize hysteria and recognize moral panics when they, you know, when inevitably the next one comes along. But I think this fear of youth is very destructive. I mean, it's a very destructive, at times it has very destructive manifestations. You know, in the 90s, you had this this concept of the super predator, which was this, what turned out to be basically a myth of this, you know, urban youth without any sort of moral compunction, that was, you know, this new level of predator. And that led to a lot of really draconian, you know, it led to juveniles being tried as adults, and, you know, minimum sentencing, and, you know, real consequences. And I think this fear of youth kind of plays into the school to prison pipeline that we have now, which is, in, you know, when you start putting police force in to do the security in schools, you know, the police have a way to deal with conflict that social workers and teachers don't. And so kids end up on this track where they're, instead of being suspended for something, they're now being charged with a crime, and they haven't even, you know, gotten out of high school, and they're these infractions are building up, and before you know it, they're headed straight into the justice system, and you know, we all know that the justice system doesn't treat everybody fairly, and so some people get lost in it. Mm-hmm. So it's really a consequence of, you know, what we're presenting in the book is really, you know, exposing the war on fun, and it's but the darker side of it that we weren't really able to get into as much as we wanted to is this sort of pervasive this result of this fear, which is, you know, more kids being incarcerated.
And I think you sort of lead towards that towards the end of the book, and you make some really stark comparisons, such as the diet, you know, between a high school and a prison. And I know that the company that provides the food at the college that I teach also provides food for prisoners, and yeah. So it's, you know, quite evident in many ways, and around the surveillance, and we certainly see this in the social service sector as well, that, you know, young people who come into care are far more likely to be charged while in care for sanctions that, you know, parents wouldn't charge a young person for. You know, often we're not going to charge a young person for punching a hole in the wall or for breaking curfew. They're not going to call the police. Whereas in the social service system, we do that. And so we end up with young people who are being criminalized because of the nature, the very nature of being involved in the system. As we end, how can adults challenge this? How can adults, I mean, I recommend that every group home and school buy a copy or two of this book, and and don't get too angsty if it gets stolen by somebody leaving the group home. But I, you know, I'm going to recommend it for the librarian at my college, certainly. But I would recommend every group home get this book, because I think it, not only is it a fun and fascinating read, but it also allows many, many opportunities for discussion with young people, particularly as a service provider is trying to help them navigate the world. How can adults ally with young people around some of the themes you bring up in the book?
Well, I think, I certainly think parents can, parents parents of kids in particular school systems can sort of look for, you know, advocate against the overuse of security or the overuse of you know, police in the school system, or hysterical reactions to, you know, we have a whole chapter on zero tolerance, where or a map of zero tolerance, which just completely absurd moments where kids are being suspended for pointing a chicken finger at a teacher and going bang bang, you know, like a third grader or something like that, and this sort of hyper reaction to the tragedy of school shootings, you know, bear a reaction, but there are sort of these overreactions where, you know, and so I think if parents see that happening in their own school districts, they should push against it, or kids being suspended for, you know, having long hair and things like that. I think parents really need to advocate for their kids' rights. You know, there's great organizations like the ACLU is out there challenging laws and issuing reports and, you know, defending the rights of youth, and so supporting those sort of organizations, or the National Youth Rights Association. I think, you know, in the, I would say in general, sort of trying to introduce a level of rationality and just people trying to calm down a bit and try. I think something that's, in a way, I wonder if this book came out of, I did two or three graphic novels about my own experiences, you know, somewhat based on my own experiences, but about the sort of rites of passage and transitional moments of my own teen years, one of which centers on some, you know, short experience I had as a shoplifter, and how I sort of, you know, had I been in a different environment, a different context, or if my store owner and my father hadn't sort of done what you would call, an alternative to incarceration sort of situation, you know, I might have ended up on this road as well. And I think people need to realize that teens do things at one age that doesn't mean that they are a super predator or are headed down a road to criminality. So I feel like, and I think there's something, I think it's sort of, at least in America, I think there's more and more awareness of these overreactions, and there's a lot more media stories about it and pushback. And so I'm hoping that the tide is turning a little bit. But it's always hard because you have, you know, a certain inertia that institutions have as opposed to the feelings of individuals. But I think, you know, we're hoping with this book that we're raising, that, you know, that we're reaching kids who will, you know, speak up for themselves and who can form youth rights groups and who can, you know, realize that they're not isolated in these situations and that there's an alternative to the way they're being treated. So we would hope to sort of make involve democratic, you know, involve citizens with this book. So
and I think it certainly shows many opportunities to do that as well, particularly in the last chapter when you talk about youth-led organizations, as well as shows the effects of not doing that. And as I said in the introduction, you know, there's example after example of how it actually ended up harming young people and how detrimental many of these policies have been. And the most, you know, glaring example in the book, of course, is the zero tolerance policies and the school to prison pipeline. I want to thank you, Kevin, for having the interview, doing the interview with me today, and both you and Scott for writing this book. It's a wonderful book, and I really encourage everyone to pick up a copy, and I'll link to the book website as well. Thank you very much for taking the time today.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher and visit us at c2ypodcast.org.